Hello and welcome to Dialect Radio, coming up to you from Bristol City Centre. Hello to all our listeners in Preston and Birmingham and those accessing the show through the internet. This week we visit the Tollpuddle Annual Festival. We speak to Roger Ball, who'll be talking to us about the history of the Tollpuddle Martyrs. We also speak to Nina Franklin, who is the Vice President of the NUT. We also have features from Johnny Warden, Anthea Page, and we also have Malcolm Grieve reading another instalment of Secrets and Lies. We have Tim Burrows, who's reading us another poem, and Jeff Sparks, of course, brings us his What's On guide as usual. So, first of all, we have Roger Ball with us, and you are from the Bristol Radical History Group.
Yeah, that's right.
Hi,
yeah.
Good to meet you.
Yeah, cheers for getting me in.
So, tell us about the Tollpuddle Martyrs. Who are they?
Well, I'm going to take you back a little bit because the Tollpuddle Martyrs are a very important bit of trade union history, but they also relate to how rural workers and urban workers organised in the early part of the trade union history we have now. So take us back a little bit into the 18th century, mm-hmm. workers started to try and organise to improve their wages and conditions in the 18th century, and they formed things called combinations, which just literally small groups of workers got together. They had like friendly societies where they tried to help each other with welfare, mm-hmm. they tried to petition for better wages, all sorts of things that really make up what our modern society is about, health, education. Mm-hmm. So now, obviously, there was opposition to this.
Yeah.
A lot of the people, the landowners and the factory bosses didn't like this idea because they wanted to control wages.
Yeah, sure.
So through the 18th century, a lot of laws were brought in to try and ban what were called combinations. It got particularly severe after the French Revolution because mm-hmm. it was perceived that if workers organised and started to get some rights, that they might start demanding things like democracy.
God forbid.
Horror. So after the French Revolution in Britain, there were a lot of repressive laws brought in which tried to stop freedom of speech. They tried to stop people organising in early forms of trade unions. But interestingly, in 1824, some of these laws, these anti-union laws, were repealed. There was a feeling that the French Revolution wasn't so much of a threat.
Died down a bit.
That's right, yeah. So things opened up a little bit. So workers did start to organise at that stage. I'll take you now to a little village called Tollpuddle in Dorset.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tollpuddle is near Dorchester. In 1830-31, there'd been a very large uprising of agricultural labourers. And the reason this happened was because wages had been falling. And the main reason wages had been falling in rural areas was that you had mechanisation coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So there was lots of unemployment. Wages were falling as a result, because when there's lots of unemployed, then bosses can push the wages down because people are desperate for work. So to give you an idea of their wages at the time, typical agricultural labourer was probably earning 10 shillings a week, and often had more than 4 or 5, 6, 7 children to feed.
Mm.
And those wages fell all the way through the late 1820s into the 1830s. Consequently, there was a whole series of protests and riots across Britain called the Swing Riots. They were sort of viciously repressed in 1831.
Mm-hmm.
252 people were sentenced to death by the authorities in Britain.
Wow.
600 people were actually transported to Australia. Transportation is where, rather than kill people, they decided they could use them as forced labourers. So they would send them out to the colonies, and that's where a lot of people were sent to Australia and Tasmania to work, and other colonies as well. So there'd been a lot of repression in Dorset in 1831. In 1834 in Tollpuddle, there was a kind of new move to try and organise in a slightly different way, and that was to form these friendly societies.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of affiliated to a much bigger trade union which had formed because of the relaxing of the law, called the Grand National Consolidated Trades Union, which was started by some socialists, including Robert Owen, and it claimed to have around 500,000 members at the time. So in Tollpuddle, a Methodist preacher called George Lovelace decided to form a friendly society to try and improve the labourers' wages, and he invited the village to meet. 40 men from the village, which was pretty much most of the agricultural labourers of the village of Tollpuddle,
mm-hmm.
met together and decided to form this friendly society and join the trade union movement. The first 6 labourers were enrolled in the union, and their names were it was George Lovelace himself,
yep.
James Brine, James Hammett, James Lovelace, Thomas Stanfield and John Stanfield. And they kind of made an oath to say, when you joined a trade union or a friendly society in those days, you made an oath to say you were committed to the friendly society. Now, unfortunately for them, this is December 1833, they made this kind of public oath taking. Unfortunately, the local landowner was very, very powerful. Was a guy called James Frampton. He was very, very closely connected to the Whig Home Secretary in the government, Lord Melbourne, who'd been one of the people who'd viciously repressed the swing riots. Frampton wasn't very happy about these labourers joining a union, obviously. So he kind of petitioned Lord Melbourne, and between them they came up with a plan to kind of nail this activity, to stamp on it. So they couldn't use the combination laws because they'd kind of gone. So they decided to go for a mutiny charge, a charge of treason. That was declaring an oath. And interesting, that law comes from some naval mutinies in 1797. So it kind of uses very odd law to try and suppress a trade union.
Like declaring an oath other than to the king.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, right. You're allowed to commit oaths, but you have to do them in front of magistrates. So if you declared to an oath to join a trade union, the magistrate wouldn't have been very
absolutely
happy.
Absolutely, yeah.
Frampton himself, the landowner, was also the local magistrate. So you can kind of see a little pattern here. The landowners, the bosses, were often involved in the law. They were often involved in government. Mm-hmm. They kind of had it all sewn up.
Yeah.
So in February 1834, a few months later, they arrested the six men who'd first made the oath to join the trade union. And they arrested them under this mutiny charge, amongst many other charges, but that was the main one. And they were tried at Dorchester in the Assizes. In March 1834. I just want to read you a comment by George Lovelace, one of the Tolpuddle martyrs, who described the court case. And he said, "The whole proceedings of the court case were characterised by a shameful disregard of justice and decency. The most unfair means were resorted to in order to frame an indictment against us." So these innocent men were basically fitted up.
Yeah.
Pretty much fitted up by the local landowners and the government. They were found guilty and sentenced to 7 years transportation to Australia. And they were sent off, basically. Before they went, in London, there was a meeting of 1,000 people to try and petition against this charge. There was a demonstration of 200,000 people in London. And a petition was with 800,000 signatures was handed into Parliament. Unfortunately, they went ahead with it. So initially it looked like this campaign to freedom had failed.
That's a huge amount of people mobilising their support.
And interestingly, these were people from the cities, you know, and they had probably little connection with Dorset. They had certainly didn't know these men.
Sure.
So it was a massive show of solidarity by the urban working class, particularly in London and Manchester and other big cities. So they went to Australia. The campaign continued, and eventually they were pardoned in March 1836, and they did come back to Britain. And you'd think the story would end with a sort of happy ending there, that they'd come back.
It doesn't.
Well, kind of and kind of not. I mean, the biggest problem they had was they couldn't go back to Tolpuddle. I mean, for starters, the place was completely controlled by the landowner Frampton, who tried to, if he could have had his way, probably would have had them executed. But
yeah.
So they couldn't move back to Tolpuddle. But people who'd been involved in the campaign, and many, many working class people around the country, raised money, and they were actually allowed to, they went to live in Essex for a while. They got a tenure for 7 years to work there. So they were supported by people, you know, because they had no money, and obviously they would never get any work again in the area where they lived.
Sure.
So that was kind of quite good. But eventually, the five of the six Tolpuddle martyrs left and went to Canada, which is very interesting because a lot of rural labourers were actually, shall we say, they had a policy of assisted emigration, the government. They were trying to get rid of these rural labourers. They didn't really want these unemployed people around. They didn't know what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of encouraged lots of people to leave the country. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people from Dorset in Canada. There's also a lot of Dorset people in Australia still who never came back, who'd been sent there as, you know, because they were transported. And unfortunately, the last Tolpuddle martyr didn't leave the country, didn't go to Canada. And I've got to say, the Tolpuddle martyrs are remembered in Ontario and Canada as well. It's quite a big sort of understanding of what had happened. If you go and look on websites, you'll see the connection. But the last Tolpuddle martyr really had the saddest story, I think, because he actually died in Dorchester Workhouse. The workhouses, which kind of really took off in 1834 around the same time, really were the resting place for a lot of poor rural labourers. So.
Yeah.
It's kind of an important story and also a sad story as well in some ways.
I mean, it's really fascinating. I mean, they are the, like, people being commemorated with the Tolpuddle Annual Festival, which happened last weekend. I mean, do you know when that festival started and when they've started to be commemorated like that?
Or? Well, obviously, they were really well known about. I mean, they were kind of a cause célèbre in the 1830s, and they were well known about in the 19th century by trade unionists. Mm-hmm. They became sort of iconic in the movement. But really, it gets remembered in the 20th century in 1934 when the TUC decided to make Tolpuddle a kind of, you know, kind of the birthplace of the trade union movement.
Yeah.
So they are remembered, you know, from that moment, but they were well known in the 19th century, and obviously with those, you know, millions of people were aware of their struggle.
Sure.
And it is very important because it shows that you know, that the struggle to get trade unions was not easy.
No.
And it was something that we really need to remember as well.
Wow. So, and that show of solidarity is still happening today, so that's fantastic.
That's right, yeah.
And can people find out more about your radical history group in Bristol? Where do they need to go?
Right, well, we've got a website, which is www.brh.org.uk. So that's brh.org.uk.
Great.
There's plenty of stuff on there.
Cool. So thank you so much, Roger. That was fantastic. Thanks.
Cheers.
We're now going to hear a series of interviews from the Tolpuddle Festival.
I'm at the graveyard. Tolpuddle. I'm standing next to Billy Bragg. He's promised to do an interview later. And they're all in line with the wreaths. Tony Benn here as well. Tim Lazar from the TUC.
Privilege as ever to be here today to share in the celebration of the values shared by the trade unions and the churches, values of justice and fairness, which forced, and I say forced, these six men getting on for 200 years ago to do what they did. And the same values which led to the public outcry, which eventually led to their pardon and return. And we recognise those men, those values, their bravery, and what they led to as we gather at the grave of James Hammett, the one of those six men who stuck it out here and was not forced by public opinion to move away. So I lay this wreath on the grave of James Hammett, but remembering all six martyrs on behalf of the Methodist Church.
Tony Benn's going up next. That's three wreaths now laid. So Ben Bradshaw's going up to lay his wreath on behalf of the Labour Party. One from the TUC now. Billy Bragg's laying his wreath now. The Red Notes Choir singing. Ben Bradshaw, Tolpuddle again. Nice to meet you again.
Nice to see you as well.
So tell us, how is Tolpuddle different this year?
Oh, well, it's different every year. The weather always seems to shine on us, which is very nice. It seems to be getting bigger and bigger every year, which is very encouraging. And the ceremony here in the churchyard is certainly bigger this year than I've ever known it before, and always very, very moving. I can never resist shedding a tear during this ceremony. It's one of the most moving occasions that I attend any time in the year.
So do you think the trade union movement now needs more supporters than ever?
I certainly think we need to rebuild the trade union and the labour movement together if we're going to prevent what this new government is trying to do to our country. We face, in all probability, the biggest onslaught on the living standards of working people, on the freedoms of working people, on our public services that we've ever seen in the modern age. And they have no mandate for this. And we have to make sure, those of us who believe in social justice and social reform and progressive politics, that they don't succeed. And that means we do have to rebuild and we have to organise and we have to agitate. That's what Toll Puddle is all about, and I think there's a great spirit of anger combined with determination to fight.
Hello, Billy.
Hi.
Bragg.
Yeah.
Can you say something for Community Radio, Bristol Community Radio, this afternoon?
Yeah. Hi, Bristol Community Radio.
Oh, I know, you're just being funny now.
No, I'm not. If you want to do an interview, you have to ask me questions. You
all
can't
right.
just say something. You have
right.
to actually sort of formally ask me a question, which I can then formally answer.
Well, tell us why you like Toll Puddle then.
Because it's local, and it's free, and it finishes at 6 o'clock, and it's family friendly, and there's no fence.
So what about the trade union then?
Oh, that and all, yeah. But as a festival, I do a lot of festivals, and this one is a really special one.
So what do you like about it then?
All the things I just said. It's free, it's no fence, it's family friendly, and it's local.
And are you going to sing later on?
That's right, I'm here.
And what are you going to sing?
You said
I had to ask you questions.
That's right, I haven't worked it out yet. I'm going to have to have a sniff around the audience to see who's who.
Okay. So everyone is grouped around the grave. The wreaths are laid out in front, and the descendants are standing with Billy Bragg behind the wreath. So this is all the family of James Hammett, the only Toll Puddle martyr to be buried in the churchyard.
Yeah, he's not family.
Billy Bragg's pretending he's one of the family now, but someone spotted him and he's had to leave the scene.
Farewell to my family, it's now I must leave you, that far fabled shore, in chains we shall see, although we are taken, do not be mistaken, as brothers in union, we shall.
Puddle, you see, I came once and I've come back.
Yeah, it's terrific, isn't it? And I think, I mean, we're going to be lucky again with the weather. Yeah, it's Tim Lezard, and I'm the press officer for the Southwest TUC. But the sheer amount of people here, if the government wanted a message from people that were not happy with the policies and the cuts they're trying to make, they should come here, because it's absolutely huge. There's thousands of people, probably around about 10,000 people, our largest ever Toll Puddle. We've just come back from the march, which is exhilarating, the powerful, colourful banners. As far as the eye can see, normally the march gets halfway through the village, then you see the other half of it, but this year we could hardly start before the front was coming back to meet the back. It's like a big snake that doubles up on itself. The front had already reached the back before we started. It's absolutely amazing.
So do you think the trade union is on a comeback then, that people, because they are getting worried about cuts and money, that they are turning to the unions for help and advice?
I think we never went away, really. I think with the Labour government it was slightly more benign than the Conservative government at the moment, and now I think people are just angry that we've got a government that nobody really elected. You've got this coalition of two different parties that seems set on making cuts in public services, and these are cuts, of course, that are going to be affecting everybody. I mean, the people they'd be sacking are people that would be paying their taxes and working. Now they're going to be claiming the dole. So how does that add up? People say that trade unions are pale, male and stale white blokes that are in their middle ages, but it's just terrific. There's so many young people here, so many different coloured faces, different ages. I mean, it's just fantastic. It's a real celebration of trade unionism in the place where, you know, arguably trade unionism began all those years ago in 1834.
So do you think young people are joining the unions now as much?
Well, have a look yourself. You'll see so many young people here. Again, more and more come every year. They realise that if they want to achieve social justice, then trade unions is the way to do it.
I'm Tony Benz.
And you're back again at Toll Puddle. Nice to see you.
Yes, I've been for 25 years now, and it just gives me such a boost. It's like recharging my batteries to come here and see all the people and all the banners and talk to so many old friends, and it's every year it gets bigger.
Yeah, there's a lot more people here this year, aren't there?
Yes, I think there are over 5,000 here, yeah.
So what about the trade unions? Do you see them expanding, getting more popular as the cuts?
Well, I think the present government is determined to repeat what Mrs. Thatcher did and try and destroy the trade unions. And so it's going to be a very big battle ahead of us. And we need all the inspiration we get from the men of Toll Puddle.
What about the future for the public sector? Because there's terrific cuts coming up, aren't there?
Yes, well, that will bring a lot of people together, because the public sector was brought about by trade unionists and people who had the vote. They voted for what they needed, and that's always been much disliked by the Conservative Party, and they're trying to use the economic situation as an excuse for privatising, undermining trade union power and so on. And it's a big challenge to people.
So what about privatisation?
Well, that's what they want. They want everything to be under private control. Privately owned prisons, privately owned schools and so on. And I don't think people want that.
Well, it makes it more selective, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But also there's no accountability. If it's all privately owned, you can't do anything about it. Whereas with the publicly owned industries, you can raise matters in Parliament and action can be taken to meet people's needs. So it's really at heart, it's a democratic argument we're fighting for.
My family, it's now I must leave you, that far fabled shore, in chains we shall sleep. Although we are taken, do not be mistaken, as brothers in union we shall be.
Hi, my name is Jerry Hicks. I'm a Unite member from Bristol. Worked at Rolls-Royce for 31 years before I was victimised, sacked for trade union activities.
Can you tell us why you're here today?
Yeah, I'm here to commemorate the Tall Puddle Martyrs, which were people who sacrificed for the trade union movement. So I'm here to commemorate the past, but I'm also here to remind myself we need to sacrifice in the present. The 25% cuts or the 40% cuts, the job losses, the cuts to pay, pension, the hiring of retirement age. How can I stare my kids and my grandkids in the face if I don't fight in the present? It's not enough to commemorate the past, you have to do things now.
Do you think working class people are being targeted by the governments of Europe?
I think all working people are being targeted. We're being asked to pay the price of finance bosses' mistakes. And by the way, they've been backed by government after government, these bankers' bosses, who are still paying themselves massive bonuses. And we're being asked to pay the price. And I think if enough people say no, if we all spit, we'll drown them. And of course, we smashed the poll tax by defying the law.
Do you think the governments are generally frightened of people in power with the money?
They might be frightened. If they're not frightened, then they're certainly too close to them, or they might feel they're part of them, or they're just not capable of standing up to them. But they are few, we are many. There's millions and millions of us. Do you know, there was some on it, because I like things that are put simply. And it was, you know, the top 5% who own, you know, 90% of the wealth. If you went to a barbecue and there was 100 people there, and you were queuing up for your burger, and five people jumped the queue and ate nearly all the food, we'd go berserk. That's how the money's dished out. So I think, you know, general secretaries as well, not all of them, but especially those who are appointed, certainly politicians, have lost faith that people can really change things. Do you know, that's my view. That's why the anti-union legislation's not being repealed, because not enough people on our side at the top have said the right things, done the right things and led the fight. It's not enough to campaign anymore or lobby your MP. You've got to take to the streets.
But has this been going on insidiously for a long time now?
I think insidiously is a good word. You know, I think it's, you take a long time to get to where we are. Where, for example, in my union, Unite, the biggest union in the country, 1.7 million members, potentially the most powerful, funded Labour to millions of pounds for three terms. In our union, in BA, huge strike vote, a big, big dispute. We have 70 members suspended, 7 sacked. We offer £60 million in pay and conditions cuts, and we're no closer to winning. That says to me that we are in a disastrous state, and we need to fight, not just talk. We need to take to the streets when it's possible. Vestas was a good example last summer. We should have supported Vestas on the Isle of Wight. Our union didn't, and that's to their shame.
Do you think the Labour Party have sort of moved away from the trade unions?
It's not what I think. You know, you ask most others, they'll say they've moved away from the trade. How can we not come to a conclusion where after three terms, big majorities, 13 years, they failed to repeal anti-union legislation? The example I gave you, where I was victimised, trumped up charges by Rolls-Royce, one in an industrial tribunal who ordered my reinstatement, and it's the perpetrator of the crime, the employer, who gets to choose, not the victim. So, of course, they've left the trade union. Some of them are talking now as though they're the biggest friends to the trade union. Easy in opposition. When they had the chance, they didn't do it. That's a crime. Crime against working people.
Before we leave the festival, we're going to hear the brass band supported by the RMT Union playing Delilah, and they're performing outside the Martyrs Arms pub in Tolpuddle.
dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
The next section we've got coming up is talking to Nina Franklin from the Bristol NUT, and we're going to talk about education. And education is the number one measure of a civilised society, it says on my sheet. If our schools are in a mess, then it stands to reason that chaos and confusion will permeate through the whole of society as a miseducated youth grow up. Taxes are not going down, so why is it that the government never seem to have enough money to spend on our schools? For example, last week's announcement by the former member of Oxford's elite Bullingdon Club and now Conservative Education Secretary Michael Gove that he was scrapping the £55 million Building Schools for the Future programme. So I'm joined by the Secretary of the Bristol branch of the National Union of Teachers, Nina Franklin, who's going to be talking to me a bit more about education. So hi, Nina. Welcome
Hello.
To Dialect.
Hi.
Nice to meet you. So how's education changed since you entered the profession?
Well, I entered the profession over 35 years ago, actually. There's been enormous changes because we've had the development now of a number of schools which are called academies, and really the privatisation of education, which was kind of started by Margaret Thatcher, but, you know, I have to say it's been built on very much by the Blair government.
Sure. And what change is the new government trying to bring in?
The new government is trying to make schools become academies, mm-hmm. And also to allow groups of parents to set up their own schools, mm-hmm. which are going to be called free schools,
right?
Which really is something to do with the Swedish model of education, where it hasn't worked. Free schools have not worked in Sweden, and they have led to huge segregation in society, mm-hmm. And not at all the aims that Gove is putting forward. Mm-hmm. Academies are kind of independent state schools, if you like, and you know, the bad thing about this is you know, our taxpayers' money, mm-hmm. Being given to private sponsors. We've already got 7 of them in Bristol with, you know, a variety of private companies sponsoring them and also religious groups.
And they get to set their own curriculums, is that correct?
They get to set their own curriculum, and most of all, they are not democratically accountable,
sure.
to the taxpayers who are funding them.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it will lead to the breakup of local authority control.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I know the NUT often criticises Bristol City Council. However, you know, we would much rather we had a democratically accountable local authority running our schools,
mm-hmm.
than some religious group or private company.
Sure. I mean, is there any problem with private schools becoming academies, for example?
Well, I'm extremely annoyed as a you know, a council taxpayer and a taxpayer that, you know, independent schools such as, you know, the Colston Girls Schools and so on have been, mm-hmm. given taxpayers' money,
wow.
to set up schools. I mean, I you know, I really protest at that. You know, our money should be going into our local schools. You know, we need a good local school for every child in every local community.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I want all the independent schools brought back into the state system, but, you know, I don't want it to do it
being done
by them giving us our money.
Sure.
And also it damages the provision for nearby schools, you know, where, you know, people that can't afford independent school fees have sent their children.
Yeah. So, I mean, what are academy schools? Are they like private companies or charities? I mean, is there some kind of issue with their definition, do you think?
Well, academy schools are, you know, independent state schools, if you like. So,
okay.
I mean, they get the money directly from the government, and they also get the proportion of money from the local authority, which is currently held back.
Yeah.
You know, there are quite a lot of inducements for them financially. However, I mean, they can change teachers' paying conditions, and we've worked long and hard in the trade union movement to get nationally agreed paying conditions.
Yeah.
All of that will be swept out of the window. And also, I mean, you know, there are some very dodgy curriculum moves, particularly by some of the religious groups, you know, which we think are very damaging to, you know, the children and the communities that use,
sure.
those schools.
I mean, will there be the ability for them to have selection criteria then?
They can, yes, they can have a selective school. They can select who goes there. They don't, you know, they don't have to have regard for what's happening in the local area. So, yes, it will bring in a two-tier education system, which is something we've been battling against for many years.
Many years, indeed. So, I mean, do you know any economics teachers? Because are these public sector cuts necessary, especially what's been going on with the lists of building for schools, kind of all that money going.
I mean, certainly we don't believe these cuts are necessary at all. I mean, they could make a lot of other cuts. They could stop funding Trident. They could stop funding the war. You know. I mean, there is plenty of money there,
mm-hmm.
to fund schools properly. And in actual fact, you know, if we have a lot of primary schools now becoming academies, you know, they are still going to want to buy their services back from the local authority as they're doing now. So it's privatisation, it's huge profit, and there is absolutely no need, you know, for the government to be doing this. You know, the money can be found from elsewhere.
Elsewhere, yeah. I mean, so what's the wider reaction of the trade unions movement in Bristol to the threatened government cuts?
It has been very positive, and we have set up the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance. We're having a meeting this Thursday night at Barton Hill Primary School at 7:30. Mm-hmm. You know, where it's all the representatives of all the trade unions. We're getting together to have a campaign to campaign against this. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we are also campaigning in the two Bristol schools, Gay Elms Primary School and Westbury on Trim, mm-hmm. where they are planning to become academies. We will be campaigning to stop them doing that.
Wow, I think there'll be lots of people who'd be really interested in going to those meetings. I mean, can you just say it again?
The Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance. But there will be future meetings, but the person to contact is Anne Lemon, who's the NUT executive member for the area, mm-hmm. and she can be contacted on anne.lemon@tiscali.co.uk.
Okay.
And she will have all the details.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Nina.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature is by Johnny Royden, and it's a trip on a bus with the Avon Wildlife Trust.
Bristol City Centre. Urban hell or wildlife wonder? Bus journey is a great way to really look out and see what you can spot. And I've met up with several people to find out a little bit more about Bristol's wildlife and also the social history of Bristol. What was it like 50 years ago? How have people lived here? What hidden gems are there that we can go and explore?
My name is Pat Ellingham. I'm Director of Communications. You know, for many years, wildlife tended to be something that bird watchers did and specialist naturalists did. And, of course, wildlife is so important to everybody. And we just wanted to be able to find ways in which we could communicate how important wildlife is and how enjoyable it is. So the podcast is just one of many initiatives that we've been doing over the last 2 years.
And so how it works is someone will go to your website, download the podcast, and then the idea is that they listen to the recording while they take the trip.
Absolutely.
Take them up to the top of Blackboy Hill, you're getting closer to Avon Gorge and Downs. Fantastic space near the centre of Bristol. So I met up with Mandy Leavers to find out more about it.
We do have a wide variety of animals which live up here on the Downs, and a lot of them come out at night or very early in the morning when there aren't people around.
On the recording we heard now, it mentioned the nocturnal animals and seasonal variations for summertime. Would you hope to expand it to cover different seasons?
Definitely. I mean, I think we all know that there's nothing worse than a stale podcast, so we really, really would want to keep this up to date, get more voices in, keep it fresh.
Blaise Castle Estate has been playground to many a child over the years. I met up with Dennis Alloway, who grew up in South Mead and spent much of his childhood walking around the woods at Blaise.
I'm Karen Baxter, I'm the PR manager for FIRST.
How long ago did Avon Wildlife Trust approach you about this idea?
They contacted us probably about 2-3 months ago, advising us that it was their 30th anniversary and we wanted to do something quite special. And they told us about this idea they'd had for a podcast following one of the bus routes. It just seemed like a genius idea and something that we would very much want to support. I think this is about adding value to people who are already travelling on the bus. So I travelled up and down today with the launch bus and learnt things I didn't know about the bus route. So I say give it a go.
My name's Julie Doherty and I'm Learning Development Officer at Avon Wildlife Trust. The full podcast goes from the city centre all the way to Cribbs Causeway and back again. We'd like to develop some more, definitely. Maybe for train routes out to Weston-super-Mare perhaps, or other bus routes around town where people can learn about our nature reserves and also other really nice green areas around Bristol. The podcast we listen to today on this shorter version is just little sections of it, but on the full length one it's very clear where the bus stops are. There's a little bus bell and an announcement, and people can also download just sections of it if they need to. It's very clear on our website, avonwildlifetrust.org.uk/wildbus. You can just download little sections of the journey if you need to.
Say if the bus is going faster or slower than usual, it's quite easy to pause or forward to the
relevant sections?
Yeah, that's right. There's specific bus stops along the way. So if you're at that bus stop, you just need to pause it until the bus starts off again, and then you can just carry on with the podcast.
I thought it was very good. It was not quite what I expected.
Yeah, no, I thought it was really good, and it's really well timed. It's really interesting to know all about sort of around the area and stuff that you don't really pick up on much, but you always think about when you're on the bus. So no, it's really good.
I think the timing was absolutely perfect on the journey as well, and it's I think it'll be of great interest to a lot of people.
I thought it was excellent, actually, very informative, a good mix, telling you a bit about the wildlife and also giving the journey a bit of flavour as well. So I thought it was really nice.
Things that one didn't know, it was really interesting and added to one's knowledge. It's great.
It was very good indeed. It was very enjoyable.
It was lovely being high up because you could actually see lots of things, and also to be reminded about the history, you know, things like the history of the Downs, for instance. That was great, you know.
Really, really informative. Opens your eyes to what's in the city that you just take for granted that you don't see. But yeah, really, really good.
Especially as bus routes are so routine and you do them so many days, it's always wonderful to learn new things. And it's great to have something, an activity to actually look out for when you're travelling.
It's really educational. It makes people look at things that they don't normally look at. So overall, it's really good.
So often you just travel through the city centre and you don't really look around and you don't appreciate what's around you. But I think if you're kind of sitting on a bus just looking out the windows, something like that's just playing in the background rather than the normal music or whatever you listen to. You know, you get to appreciate wildlife and what's around you, and maybe, you know, if there's any threats or anything like that, you'll appreciate it and maybe stand up for a bit more if anything's, you know, going to affect the environment around you. I think it's a really good idea to getting people involved.
So soon you'll be arriving at Cribbs Causeway. So when you've finished your shopping, why not take a look around for yourself and see if you can find a little hidden corner to sit down and have a quiet moment? See if you can see any buzzards flying around, or look out for rabbits in the surrounding fields. Or maybe just find a little bit of Bristol's history that's been kindly shared with us. I hope you've enjoyed your journey, but please now get ready to disembark the bus and go and explore.
That was a feature by Johnny Royden with the Avon Wildlife Trust. Over now to Malcolm Grieve for another instalment of Secrets and Lies.
Secrets and Lies, The Truth, Very Probably, from David Southwell. We take many technologies for granted today, which the science fiction writers of a mere 50 years ago placed hundreds or even thousands of years into the future. Most of us carry around a mobile phone with a sort of computing power and data storage capability which 40 or 50 years ago would have required a building the size of the average house and an army of white-coated technicians to run it. Now you can buy one for a few pounds in the high street. Leaving aside the surveillance society, over which many of us have severe misgivings, such technology is largely benign. There is, however, a rather darker side to the technological advances of recent years. From Odin's spear, Gugnir, which could strike the gods themselves with lightning, to the deadly bolts of Zeus, mankind has associated lightning with a weapon belonging to the most powerful beings of his imagination. This connection has always made the idea that the searing power of nature could be harnessed as a weapon seem like pure fantasy. It turns out that the world of pure fantasy made a very good cover for developing ball lightning weapons in secret at the height of the Cold War, as did the fact that scientists cannot agree on exactly what causes the phenomenon. Until recently, many meteorologists dismissed ball lightning as a myth and eyewitness reports of it as lies. However, recent study has established that ball lightning, a floating, moving ball of plasma which can occur naturally during a thunderstorm, is very much a reality. Since electrical engineering pioneer Nikola Tesla claimed to have generated ball lightning in 1904, weapons developers have been excited by the prospect of creating searing balls of heat and electricity that could be projected at the enemy. In the Soviet Union during the Cold War, scientists secretly developed high-power microwave generators that allowed beams to intersect at high altitudes to create a stable ball of plasma. Details of the technology only emerged in 1993, when President Bush offered to share the American Star Wars project with the Russians. The US followed Soviet research into using microwaves to create ball lightning. Experiments led to them being able to create a system where intersecting microwave frequency beams generated a glowing sphere of light. However, the US Air Force, following a different tack, produced the first device capable of firing ball lightning. In the USAF's Phillips Laboratory in the early 1990s, a project called Marauder, magnetically accelerated ring to achieve ultra-high directed energy and radiation, managed to achieve donut-shaped rings of plasma and small balls of lightning that exploded when hitting a target. The project's initial success led to it becoming classified, and no more details of how it developed after 1993 are available. Having touched upon how CIA brainwashing program MKUltra used ex-Nazi scientists, saw CIA agents spiking people with LSD and discovered a cure for most addictions, it might be thought that there were no more secrets to divulge. However, the CIA knew the project contained even more embarrassing material, which is why it illegally destroyed all of its files on MKUltra in 1972. However, shredding all of the paperwork was not enough to keep some of the worst excesses of the project hidden. When CIA Director Alan Dulles set up MKUltra in April 1953 in response to Soviet and Chinese experimentation on American prisoners captured during the Korean War, he granted it 6% of the CIA's entire operating budget without any oversight. One strand of research this funded, without questions being asked, was the work of world-renowned psychiatrist Ewan Cameron. Aside from his clandestine role with the CIA, his acknowledged claims to fame included being the first chairman of the World Psychiatric Association and a member of the Nuremberg Medical Tribunal. Travelling to Canada to conduct his experiments for MKUltra, the CIA was less squeamish about killing Canadian citizens. Cameron used unwitting patients in Montreal Psychiatric Institutes who had been placed in his care. Cameron was intent on erasing all existing memories and rebuilding a person so they could be used as the perfect double agent or unwitting pre-programmed assassin. Using techniques hinted at in the movies The Manchurian Candidate and the Ypcres file, he attempted to de-pattern his patients by putting them into month-long drug-induced comas and playing them tape loops of electronic noise and simple commands. He also used electroconvulsive shock treatment at 40 times the normal power. One of his surviving patients, a promising 19-year-old student, ended up returning home to her family with the mental age and bladder control of an 18-month-old child. In 1976, the CIA promised the Church Committee, which was investigating the intelligence services, that it had stopped the program and would never do anything like it again. Excuse me if I find that hard to believe. In 1997, China committed an act of war against the USA. It was an act of cyber warfare that, according to sources within the CIA, was a live exercise by Chinese military hackers against the US telecommunications system. Luckily for both sides and the rest of the world, America decided to pretend it didn't happen. At 5 a.m. one morning in January 1997, a leading pager service sent out a call-me-back message to more than 100,000 of its customers. Foggy with sleep and wondering what the emergency was, thousands of people tried to call back. Most thought it was a local number, while hundreds of calls were received at a San Franciscan theological college. 36 people thought it was the pager number of another pager network customer and sent their telephone numbers back to the network to be passed on to the mystery person they thought was trying to page them. Those 36 telephone numbers were then sent to the original 100,000-plus people who got the false call-me-back message. One of those 36 was still receiving more than 300 calls an hour on the evening of the same day. The pager network apologised to all of its customers for the technical error, but the Wall Street Journal ran a story suggesting the problem had been caused by Chinese military hackers engaged in an exercise. The company did not sue the paper. This illustrates a very good way of knowing whether something you read in a newspaper is true. If someone doesn't sue over a story, it is for one of three reasons. Either the story is true, the person or organisation involved doesn't want the publicity of a court hearing, or the person who has been libelled has no money. Pagers, SMS messaging and cellular phones are all vital to contacting military and emergency service personnel in times of a terrorist attack. The technology is also increasingly used in combat situations. So the fact that a dry run by the Chinese successfully caused so much havoc is highly worrying.
Thank you, Malcolm. Time for the poetry slot, and Tim Burrows is ready and waiting with another poem. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good, and yourself?
Yeah, very good, thank you. So what do you have for us today?
It's a poem about painting, landscape painting.
Lovely.
So this is a kind of crossover between art and poetry.
Great.
Searching for the heart of landscape painting, the colours, the light, the reflection, the contour, the brush marks of the masters. Because it has to be better than a photo, to give you something else of the place, the feeling of being there, with the lonely artist and his easel, the blank canvas explored in the outline sketch, the choice of the palette squeezed out of crinkled tubes, the scratch of the hairbrushes, the smell of the oil, clouds capping worked with turquoise, flecked with white and grey, earth form undulated, drawn out, blocked in, coloured ochre to vermilion, burnt sienna to the field's clay.
That was fab, thank you. And I believe you have another one for us, Tim.
Yeah, this is in a similarly kind of art poetry theme. It's called Line. Line that curves into line. Line that draws into form. Line that underlines the form. Line that forms food for expression. Line that expresses the outlines of an idea. Line that outlines the limit of experience. line that experiences the wanderings of the mind, line that wanders with the unfolding of one's life, line that unfolds the basis of community, line that communes with the circle of living, line that circles the wheel of fortune, line that gives form to your life.
That's great. Thanks again, Tim.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And once again, we have Jeff Sparks with his What's On Guide. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 29th of July, Ed Tudor Pole will be performing with support from the Pigs at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance and £7 on the door. Also on 29th of July is the rescheduled gig for the Choir Boys at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. Moving into Friday, 30th of July, Turbo Wolf will be performing with support from the Computers and also Jewels of a Giant at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I feature the cyberpunk group Surfing Turnips. This is from the album Return to Turbo Island, and there's a track titled The Beast of Bodmin.
I remember him with the double D. Now I'm dealing with tragedy, cause I know I can't get away. I started with a trepidation. Now he's dealing with annihilation, cause I know I can't get away. I hear the call of the beast. The beast of Bodmin, I know I can't get away. It were lambing time in May, and me folks had gone away. And now the beast of Bodmin's out to play. There's one thing we gotta be told, this land be ancient, land be cruel, and I know I can't get away. When the mist is setting on the hill, they hides many forgotten ills, and I know I can't get away. I hear the call of the beast of Bodmin. I know I can't get away. For lambing time in May, and me folks had gone away. And now the beast of Bodmin's out to play.
That was Surfing Turnips with the track The Beast of Bodmin from the album Return to Turbo Island. For more information, you can check out www.myspace.com/surfingturnips. Into Saturday, 30th of July, and it's the Gimme Shelter Night featuring Tin Pan Gang, the Transpersonals, and also Radiant Sounds of Dust at the Fleece, St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 1st of August, Jar Wobble and the Nippon Dub Ensemble will be performing with support from Sakura at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
That's the end of this week's Dialect Radio. In the studio today were Roger Ball from the Bristol Radical History Group and Nina Franklin from the NUT. Features were by Johnny Royden and Anthea Page. Malcolm Grieve read Secrets and Lies by David Southwell, and Tim Burrows read us two of his poems. Finally, Jeff Sparks gave us his What's On guide. The studio engineer was Lee Duffield, and it's goodbye from me, Michaela Dennis, and see you next week.